Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I wanted to start with the political news. About the time we were talking last week, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Secretary of Health and Human Services, announced that his newest target is unspecific reforms of the country's vaccine injury compensation program, something that was set up to move the process of compensating the tiny fraction of people who are injured by vaccination through lawsuits that can take a lot of time and cost a lot of money to a government-administered program for handling out kind of predetermined award amounts in a no-fault system, kind of similar to how workers' comp works for workplace injuries. First of all, maybe you could walk us through the history. How and why did this program get set up the way it is?
Well, this program was set up in the mid-1980s. And the reason it was set up by Congress was to assure that people with who believed they had problems from vaccines were able to be compensated for those problems in a judicial fashion. The reason for that was that there were a lot of assaults on the vaccine manufacturers, claiming that there were complications from the vaccines by attorneys. And plaintiffs, of course. And this was in prior to the mid-1980s. And this was driving pharmaceutical manufacturers out of the business of producing vaccines. Need to pause here for a moment and just say that vaccines are not a big money-making proposition for pharmaceutical companies. There's a very small margin of profit. So it's something that was just anything that perturbed the system would lead to pharmaceutical companies saying, forget it, I'm not going to produce vaccines. I think we went from around 18 pharmaceutical companies in the very early 80s producing vaccines to by 1990, or by the later 1980s, four. So this was a real problem in terms of getting Americans protected with vaccines, but at the same time trying to find a way to compensate people who probably, maybe, had complications from vaccines. So that's why this court was set up.
And the reason vaccines aren't very profitable is just because they're kind of a one-and-done health intervention? There's more profit in a pill someone has to take every day?
Right. Just think about it. A statin, for example, which so many millions of Americans take to protect them from heart disease, they have to take it every day, at least for now, the rest of their lives. This is great for producing a drug like that. On the other hand, producing a vaccine that is one and done or two and done, and that's it, that is not a very profitable enterprise for vaccine manufacturers.
So, what do we speculate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. wants to do to the vaccine injury compensation program?
Well, we don't have to speculate, Brian. We can just listen to what he said. And what he said over decades now is that he wants to get rid of vaccines. He wants to do everything he can in his power to get rid of vaccines. Fortunately, up until February of this year, he didn't have any power to do that. But now he does. One of the areas that he's very interested in changing is the vaccine, this program we're talking about, VICP it's called. And the reason he wants to do that is because he wants it to make it easier for attorneys to sue the pharmaceutical companies. And at one level, that might sound like it makes a lot of sense. We should do everything we can to allow somebody who has been injured or may have been injured, thinks they've been injured from a vaccine, to have their day in court. VICP allows that, and Kennedy wants to change that system so it makes it much easier for attorneys to sue the pharmaceutical companies. He wants to take it back to where it was before the VICP was in existence. And that's a real problem, because we know what the consequences will be. The consequences will be exactly what Kennedy has said for years that he wants, and that is he wants people to stop using vaccines.
Which in this case would be accomplished by simply making the manufacturers take them off the market.
It would, and it also, there's another thing that we might expect from him, keeping the VICP, but changing it so that people can sue for many more vaccines than are on the list of things that people can sue for, which would make it very difficult for manufacturers also. And there's an interesting sidelight here. Kennedy is involved with a big lawsuit against the HPV vaccine for very spurious reasons. The human papillomavirus vaccine is a vaccine to protect people against getting cervical cancer, one of the most common cancers in the world, and it works unbelievably well. We're just seeing already a dramatic drop in cervical cancer in countries that use this vaccine. Kennedy has this belief, it's not based upon any data, any good science, that the HPV vaccine is harmful. And he's involved in the consortium of attorneys that are suing the HPV manufacturers. He wants to get HPV included in the VICP so that the compensation for this could be much greater.
This kind of overlaps with a area of kind of right-wing conservative fervor, because HPV is a childhood vaccine now, but the disease is in part a sexually transmitted infection. So conservatives don't like the idea of young girls getting inoculated against something that presumes they would be having sex.
Well, it's not just young girls, of course. We recommend it for young boys too, because while not nearly as common, there are a variety of cancers that HPV can cause in young boys. And of course, if young boys are immunized against HPV, they're not going to spread it to girls. So there's a good reason for both boys and girls to be vaccinated against this. That's right. I'd be careful, though. You know, this is not necessarily just a left-wing versus right-wing or conservative versus liberal approach. While it's true that more people who are on the conservative bent are reluctant to vaccinate their children against HPV, it's seen across the political spectrum. Fortunately, I will add that it's not seen very much across the political spectrum, because we're getting the majority now of children vaccinated and protected against getting cervical cancer, one of the leading cancer deaths in women in the world.
Yeah. A friend of mine lost her life to cervical cancer this year in her 40s.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Let's go to listener questions. It is 1-800-958-9008. If you want to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg about COVID-19 or other infectious diseases, that's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. First one comes from the inbox. This is from Steve in Connecticut, who writes, I seek clarification on what is meant when people say that a new variant of COVID-19 is related to Omicron. How much different does a strain have to be before it is not related?
That's really an interesting question. There are a variety of organizations that have opined on this, people with tremendous expertise in the evolution of viruses, and they all are a little bit different. So there's no one answer for Steve's question. There is a general answer, though. When there are significant changes, and I realize significant can be interpreted in a variety of ways, but when there are significant changes in the genetics of the virus, that's when we see a change in the variant. So we go from one Greek letter to another. But again, that's open for interpretation. Maybe another way to think about this is when there are changes in the genetics of the virus that lead to changes in the structure of the virus that make the virus much more immune evasive, that is, make the virus much more capable of avoiding our immune system. And when there are changes that allow the virus to attach to and get into our cells much better, when those significant changes occur, we'll see a burst of activity of COVID, like we saw, for example, when Omicron replaced its predecessors, when there was just an explosion of cases. So when we see something like that, certainly not on the level necessarily of Omicron, but when we see something like that, we'll say that this virus has really changed. It's a new variant. Otherwise, what
so
you hear about
it's are purely sub-variants. About the performance, not like the specific number of chromosomes that have changed from previous versions.
Generally speaking, that's correct.
And that you could have a big performance change just from one or two genetic changes, even though you could be carrying around dozens of inconsequential genetic changes in a virus that doesn't get designated a new variant.
That's correct. Yes. And it's very interesting and important for understanding the evolution of this virus. But what we as the public needs to keep an eye on are what's happening with COVID, regardless of what its genetic composition is.
1-800-958-9008 to put a question to Dr. John Swartzberg. That is 1-800-958-9008. The next question from the inbox comes from Jan in Berkeley, who asks, is the fall COVID vaccine targeted at the latest COVID variant that is dominating current infections? And if it is not, what utility is there in getting this vaccine?
That's really an important question also that Jan asks. The vaccines that will be available, hopefully, there's still confusion about this, but hopefully the vaccines that will be available sometime next month will be aimed at subvariants that are either no longer circulating or declining in circulation. So the vaccine that we're going to receive is not going to be well directed at currently what we're seeing. Now, the immediate response to that is, well, why should I bother to get the vaccine? Well, when you drill down a little more about this, that's been the case with the vaccines from the beginning. That is, it takes a lag time between the time you decide what you want to produce, what the vaccine should be aimed against, and when the vaccine is produced and then distributed. And that lag time used to be many, many, many months. Now, because of the mRNA vaccine, we're talking about a couple of months before distribution. So Jan's right to ask that question. There's good news here, though. What we're seeing circulating right now is not that different than what was circulating in the spring, in the early summer, and last fall. And the fact that it's not that different is encouraging, but we have empirical data now showing that these vaccines appear to work against subvariants that it's not directly aimed against because they're closely enough related to what the vaccines are aimed against. Bottom line to this is that several studies now, both in vitro, that is in the laboratory, as well as epidemiologic studies, are pretty convincing that the vaccine for this fall, although not perfectly aimed, is aimed closely enough and should be very effective.
I think of it mentally, and you can tell me if this is correct, Dr. Swartzberg, as each update to the vaccine is doing two things. One is that it's just refreshing your immune response. It's dealing with waning immunity, that over time your body produces fewer antibodies targeted at COVID. And the same vaccine you got last year would give you that refresh. And the second is when you do get an update, it's doing a recalibration. It is showing your immune system a spike protein in a more updated version with the latest genetic changes, hoping that this produces an incrementally more effective immune response to what's in circulation. That would be new when the vaccine gets updated, but there's still a lot of benefit without that update, just from the refresh.
Perfectly said. That's exactly right, Brian.
Okay. 1-800-958-9008 for your Corona calls. Our first caller on the line is Michael in Cherryland. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Just to follow up with these different variants, I'm wondering what's the efficacy of the testing that we have currently available, especially with the rapid tests and the three-pronged approach that we can use. Can we trust those to give us, not positive, false positives or negatives? Is there some work being done on upgrading those?
And, Michael, what do you mean by three-pronged approach?
Well, there's the three-part, the test for three different flus, at the same time.
Oh, got you. You mean the test you can get that test you for COVID and influenza simultaneously now?
Yeah, and everything else. I'm just wondering if, just in general, if the rapid tests are also still efficacious in terms of determining, our contagion.
Gotcha. Dr. Swartzberg.
Michael asks a very important question, and I am happy to say that all the evidence we have, which is considerable, suggests that these tests, whether it's the antigen test, the home test that most people use, or a PCR test that has multiple different viruses on it, including SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID, these tests appear to be very accurate against the currently circulating subvariants. We haven't seen a problem, generally speaking, with our testing. We haven't had to tweak it very much to make it, to continue to allow it to be very sensitive. So I think going into this rise in cases we're seeing now and whatever the fall and winter is going to bring us, we can count on these tests being very accurate, Michael.
Mechanistically, Dr. Swartzberg, as I understand it, this is because we mostly see mutations in the spike protein, the part of the virus that like attaches to cells, and the tests target a much more stable part of the virus's genome. They're detecting the I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right, the nucleocapsid.
Right. The tests are designed to do exactly that, Brian, and that is to test portions of the virus, nucleocapsid, for example, that are stable. And that leads us into just a very brief discussion about future vaccines. What we're looking for is a vaccine that will attack these stable portions of the virus that don't change, regardless of how the spike protein changes. And if we can find a vaccine that does that, then we have what people are calling a universal vaccine. That is, it's going to be good no matter how the virus changes. That's the holy grail. We're not there yet.
I think an important caveat to saying that the tests work, and this is an important question from Michael, is that the home tests have, since their inception, been less sensitive. If you get a positive, there is almost no chance it's a false positive. But if you get a negative, you might have COVID. And what I've read is that now that most people have a primed immune system because of vaccination or prior infection or both, it is eminently possible to get pretty significant symptoms before you have enough viral load in your nose to turn the test positive. In my case, with the COVID infection I caught a couple weeks ago, I'd had a day of symptoms and was starting to run a fever. On the first day of symptoms, I had a negative test. It wasn't until the second day that the line turned positive for me.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that, Brian. That's been a caveat for our home testing, the antigen testing, since the beginning. That is, if it's positive, you've got COVID. If it's negative, you may or may not have COVID, so keep testing. The PCR test, which is the test that's typically done, although not always, but typically done at a doctor's office or at a laboratory, is a much more sensitive test. That if it's negative and you have symptoms, it's very unlikely your symptoms are due to COVID.
But the home test, as I understand it, the main utility of it is a very good correlate of infectiousness. So even though you can't count on it to tell you you're free from infection, you can count on it to tell you whether you are likely to infect someone else for the next couple hours.
Generally speaking, that's correct. And that's why I think that it's a good idea if you've had COVID, not just to follow the CDC's recommendations about isolation, and that is 24 hours of feeling better and no fever for at least 24 hours. So your symptoms are getting better and you've not had fever for 24 hours and not taken anything to bring your fever down like aspirin or Tylenol, that you can come out of isolation. I think it's a good idea of coming out of isolation to check and see if your antigen test is still positive. And if it is, I think you have to assume that you're still likely to be contagious and to stay in isolation, to stay away from people so you don't spread the virus. And that particularly is important if you're around people who are at increased risk for a bad outcome.
Yeah, the case I just got over, I got rebound. So I had positive tests for a total of 16 days in a row, which leaves me extraordinarily skeptical of that, the latest version of the CDC guidance over how soon you can break isolation. You know, my symptoms weren't bad, but there was a lot of canceled social plans, and I don't think our friends would have been very happy with me if I had taken the green light from the CDC 5 days after my fever went away. Let's see, Dr. Swartzberg, probably one more announcement I should throw out there before we wrap up for the day, because this is the question that came up from Jan. A ton of our listeners are going to be Kaiser patients because they're the biggest health provider in the region. We found out, my wife and I, when we were getting through our most recent COVID infection, Kaiser's still giving out free test kits. Kaiser members get 4 free tests a month if you just show up with your Kaiser number at one of their pharmacies. So the federal government isn't putting them in the mail anymore, but you can still stockpile them and have them ready for when you need them, without spending any money out of your own pocket. Dr. John Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you. And I'm glad you're feeling better.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.